Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We're trying to provide you with some news you can use from the medical journals and culled from various sources that cross my desk. And we're marching through October's issue, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, trying to glean articles of practical import for you. And here's one that I think is highly significant. Headline, prenatal supplementation with DHA improves attention at 5 years of age, a randomized control trial. A little background on this is that EPA and DHA, eicosapentaenoic acid and docosahexaenoic acid, are the primary constituents of fish oil supplements. And you get EPA and DHA in varying amounts depending on the supplement. DHA is known to be important for neurological development. In animals, DHA deficiency can cause blindness. That's been shown experimentally. Certainly the blindness is related to lack of proper maturation of the neurons that transmit light signals to the brain. This has been demonstrated in cats and other experimental animals. So it's been the practice for several decades across the world to provide DHA in artificial formula for babies. Because human breast milk contains substantial amounts of DHA. It actually depends on the maternal intake of EPA and DHA. That's why it's important that if mom is breastfeeding, she's got to take some fish oil or a DHA supplement. And then the baby's going to get some DHA, and that hopefully will help them with neurological development. So it was many years before the United States adopted what had become an international standard, which is to put a little DHA into every bottle of formula that's sold to nursing moms across the world. The USA is extremely slow and conservative at adopting that. And so many babies may have been deprived of the benefits of DHA or the supposed benefits of DHA until fairly recently. I think it's only a few years back, maybe less than a decade, that they approved the use of DHA in formulas. Now all formulas have to have a little DHA. However, studies have been kind of inconsistent about whether DHA makes baby smarter. I think there have been some studies, recently that show that maternal supplementation of DHA didn't have a dramatic impact on kids' IQ at the age of two. So then the question is DHA worthwhile? Well, here's a study that certainly suggests that prenatal supplementation with DHA improves attention at 5 years of age. Okay, so big problem in America, attention deficit disorder. And what they find here is that prenatal exposure to DHA may contribute to improved sustained attention in preschool kids. The study was performed, obviously, over more than 6 years. They gave moms either DHA supplementation or placebo, and lo and behold, the kids did better. Children in the DHA group had significantly fewer omissions on a test called the KCPT than did children in the control group. And so conclusion is that while prenatal supplementation with DHA had no overall effect on global measures of cognitive functioning, so on the one hand, you know, the kids weren't smarter, but there was a benefit in terms of attention. And they also say that the quality of the home environment has something to do with this. And a negative home environment was less harmful to the kids in terms of attention when mom was given DHA. So DHA may antidote some of the effects of a, shall we say, chaotic or less stimulating home environment. That's actually one of the things that they tried to control for, you know, what happens? I mean, some of this is nature, some of this is nurture. Is it the DHA, or is it what's happening in the home environment? You know, it's important to spend a lot of time with the kid, enriching them with stimulating play toys and lots of reading, talking to the kid, interacting with the kid. I really feel sorry for some of the kids who are being pushed around by governesses or au pairs here in New York while mom goes to work, and the au pair's on the cell phone, and the kid's in the carriage staring straight ahead, has absolutely no interaction or contact with their caregiver all day long until mom gets home late at night, and then maybe they get a little attention. Well, that's a type of sensory deprivation that probably doesn't bode well for the kid, but according to the studies, DHA may partially antidote that. There's no substitute for very intensive one-on-one maternal and parental interaction. But so this is important. It says there is evidence that the benefits of improving nutrition during the first 1,000 days of life on cognitive outcomes may not become evident until children start school and are more challenged by the environment. So they're going to try to keep studying this. The study only lasted for 5 years. Therefore, the long-term significance of these findings on cognitive and behavioral functioning during the school years, which is after 5 years, remains to be determined. So stay tuned for results on DHA's impact on kids' performance in later years. Okay, you're really going to love this study because it is right in your wheelhouse in terms of relevance. The title of the study is High Red Meat Intake and All-Cause Cardiovascular and Cancer Mortality. That's pretty important. And one feature of the study is whether the risk is modified by fruit and vegetable intake. Okay, so sometimes it is said that one of the reasons that studies seem to show that red meat is bad for you is that the people who consume a lot of red meat tend to be the very self-same people who don't eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. I would consider myself and possibly some of you as an exception, because I consume a fairly large amount of red meat in the form of grass-fed beef. You'll have grass-fed brisket or skirt steak or T-bone steak, porterhouse, sirloin, and I'll also sometimes have hamburger and lamb burger, make meatloaf, stuffed cabbage, you know, and red meat is a routine part of my diet, but I also consume lots and lots of fruits and vegetables. So I'm not that typical fast food eater who just goes out and eats lots of hamburgers and hot dogs and then disdains eating their fruits and vegetables. So in this study, they tried to they did something interesting also in this study. The study involved 74,645 Swedish men and women. And they also, this is a good thing that they did in this study, which is a lot of studies haven't done, is when they ask about red meat, they don't differentiate between processed meat and unprocessed meat. Processed meat would be like salami, bologna, hot dogs, ham, you know, lunch, various types of luncheon meat, versus cuts of, you know, regular cuts of beef. And they didn't, there's no study to date that looks at grass-fed or organic, because that would be too hard to do. There's not enough people doing that, and, you know, they haven't gotten around to studying them. But at least they broke it down as to whether the red meat, what proportion was processed and what proportion was unprocessed. So here's what they found. They did find that red meat intake was considerably higher in men, and the prevalence of diabetes increased together with the consumption of red meat. They also found that higher concentrations of total red meat were associated with a progressively higher mortality risk compared with the lowest concentrations of red meat. So, that is concerning, is that, you know, on the face of it, red meat is associated with a higher risk of cardiovascular disease, and diabetes, and overall higher mortality risk. However, what they found was increased intakes of non-processed meat were not associated with higher mortality. So when it came to meat, you had to distinguish between the processed and the unprocessed. Overall red meat that includes processed, yes, higher risk of dying. But increased risk of non-processed meat was not associated with higher mortality. They say that high consumption of processed red meat was associated with higher mortality. Interestingly, they did not observe a significant relationship between total red meat consumption and cancer. So even when you looked at processed meat, they didn't contribute to cancer risk. So they didn't even have to differentiate processed versus non-processed. Red meat, period, not related to cancer risk. And, you know, that really pushes back against the China study, which alleges that animal protein, and in particular red meat, but also dairy, is the cause of all the ravages that we experience in the West, and that China has been relatively spared these ravages, that is, until modern times with prosperity when more of these foods were introduced, and thus trying to buttress a vegetarian argument. Okay, so they say also they study pretty carefully how much in the way of fruits and vegetables were consumed, and they could not determine whether the potential harmful effects of red meat can be counterbalanced by a high consumption of healthy foods such as fresh vegetables. So the study did not really support that. It did support the idea that, quote, it reinforces the evidence that processed and non-processed types of red meat might have different consequences on health, differences that should be taken into account when planning dietary recommendations. They seem to be a little disappointed that they couldn't demonstrate the protective effects of high consumption of healthy foods, such as fresh vegetables and fruits, because they explain that one of the reasons why they think meat could be harmful is because it creates excess iron. Iron is creates a free radical state, reactive oxygen species, fresh fruits and vegetables contain nutrients and phytochemicals with antioxidant capabilities, which can offset the pro-oxidant effect of the iron in a high meat diet. And also processed meat contains high concentrations of sodium, which is an important determinant of blood pressure, which of course has an impact on cardiovascular risk and death and stroke. And fresh fruits and vegetables are an important source of potassium and may therefore attenuate the negative effects of a diet high in processed meat. They also say that processed meat contains what are called N-nitroso compounds, nitrates, which are shown to be carcinogenic, that phytochemicals in fresh fruits and vegetables may inhibit the carcinogenic effects of these N-nitroso compounds. Therefore, it is plausible that high fruit and vegetable consumption could protect against the increased risk of cancers associated with high meat consumption, but they didn't demonstrate it in this study. They're trying to say, we think it's reasonable, but in conclusion, we documented that high intakes of red meat were associated with higher risk of all-cause and cardiovascular mortality, but not cancer. And when you broke it down to processed versus unprocessed, the processed meat was the culprit, not the unprocessed. And they could not demonstrate a attenuating effect on the harmful effects of processed red meats with either low, medium, or high fruit and vegetable consumption. So, I think still hedge your bets by consuming lots of fruits and vegetables. The take-home message is don't consume processed red meat, but it's okay to consume some unprocessed red meat, certainly according to this study. I think that's some very, very useful take-home information. This next study, by the way, all these studies are from are gleaned from one issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, October 2016. So you may say, well, I want to subscribe to the the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Yeah, go ahead and do it, but good luck in trying to pore through these articles that are full of real technical language. And, you know, as they sometimes say, sit back and leave the driving to us. I can help interpret these studies and cull for you the studies that are of clinical relevance, because there's some studies, frankly, that, you know, just leave my eyes crossed, and I don't even pass them along to you, because I don't know of what clinical import they are except to nutrition scientists, and have very little impact on lay people. This one does, though. It's called Heritability of High Sugar Consumption Through Drinks and the Genetic Correlation with Substance Use. Okay, what's that about? Well, it's about addiction, and it's about the relationship between addiction to sugar and addiction to addictive substances. They say that in 1970, it was already observed that smokers consumed more sugar in total and in their coffee and tea than never former smokers. Moreover, individuals who were dependent on alcohol or drugs had a higher sweet preference than did non-dependent individuals. These findings have led to the suggestion that neuronal circuits in the brain that are responsible for the development of addiction and obesity are related. Yeah, the sugar and drugs and alcohol hit the same part of the brain. What a concept. Although most of the evidence in support of this hypothesis stemmed from animal research. Well, you know, I got to tell you, just anecdotally, in med school, they assigned us to go to AA meetings when we were in studying psychiatry, because they said, hey, check this out. You know, we think you should know about it. I wasn't alcoholic at the time, but I went to an AA meeting and I disclosed that, you know, I was just there to observe. They gave me permission to sit in. And I found it fascinating because when I walked in, there were a bunch of people in the room, and there was a big cloud of smoke because everybody was smoking, and had a big urn of coffee brewing, and I had a big pile of donuts and sweets on the table. And the notion was that the most important addiction for people to curtail was their alcohol, and that they could then sate their addictive appetites with all manner of other foods, so long as they didn't take a drink. And this has actually been one of the critiques of AA, is that, you know, while certainly healthier not to be drinking alcohol, which clearly can kill you, some of these other substances can slowly kill you. And there's actually a term, dry drunk, which means that you haven't really gotten to the underlying addictive behavior that propelled you to alcohol, and maybe that's hardwired in the brain, and, you know, maybe it's just preferable to go on to these less damaging supplements, but it sure isn't good for you because, you know, a lot of health consequences to overconsumption. So what they did in this study, they examined this, and they came to the following conclusions. There were a large number of twins in this study. And they say, to our knowledge, this is the first study to investigate the heritability of sugar consumption and its genetic correlation with substance use in a large population-based sample of Dutch twins. So what they found was that there was a genetic component and there was an environmental component. And those components were about 50-50, okay, for the consumption of sugar. Through drinks, we showed a heritability estimate of 48%. So there's some people who are clearly more prone to sugar consumption. And they say that there was a moderate association between sugar consumption and substance use that they believe is largely due to genetic factors. So in other words, if the twins were raised in different circumstances, they were still more likely than by chance to crave sugar and to crave substances. So that, I think, is really interesting. It kind of confirms the notion that some of our cravings are hardwired, and some people are extraordinarily susceptible to craving. On the other hand, it does leave open the possibility that proper environment and free will can help us overcome these cravings, because these cravings are not 100% determined. They're only partially determined. So they say, with the current study, we show the importance of genetic factors for an individual's intake of sugar-containing drinks. Some individuals seem less able to resist the temptations of drinks that are high in sugar, possibly because the individuals are more perceptive to the taste, or because they experience more rewarding effects. We know that there are genes that determine sweet taste, and there are genes that affect the brain pleasure centers that make them more vulnerable to addiction. The association to sugar use and substance use was partly genetic in nature, and a possible explanation is that this association is due to a general lack of ability to resist rewarding stimuli. I love that phrase. How many of us experience a general lack of ability to resist rewarding stimuli? I love this dry scientific language. We are prey to temptation, yeah, because we are human. They say the common or family environment was of little importance for individual differences in sugar consumption. You know, it's actually, some of this is hardwired, and there is overlap with other substance use. So, useful, study indeed. And finally, this study, you know, because we tend to look at vitamin D, as a panacea for everything. And in fact, there is a known association, between vitamin D and obesity. So logically speaking, let's, you know, all take vitamin D to help us shed pounds. Good idea or bad idea? I'll summarize this briefly for you. Vitamin D status and weight loss, a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized and non-randomized controlled weight loss trials. What they found was that indeed people who are overweight have lower vitamin D. But is it true that if you give vitamin D to overweight people, will they lose weight more readily than those who don't get the vitamin D? And the answer is, according to the trials, our results indicate that vitamin D status may be marginally improved with weight loss in comparison with weight maintenance under similar conditions of supplemental vitamin D intake. In other words, you lose weight and your vitamin D will go up. It'll go up because why? Because fat cells suck up your vitamin D and hold on to it, and it doesn't appear in your blood, and it doesn't register as circulating vitamin D. And therefore, it is more likely reverse causation. Okay? Reverse causation means it is the weight loss itself. I'm sorry, the overweight itself. It is being fat that leads to suboptimal concentrations of circulating vitamin D. Rather than vice versa, that vitamin D high levels keeps people thin or helps people who are overweight, lose weight. Nonetheless, you know, vitamin D is very important, may play a role in optimizing, insulin sensitivity. We do think that it, may have, a sensitizing effect in type 2 diabetes, maybe a weak sensitizing effect. And certainly, could, have health benefits in overweight individuals who are insulin resistant. It just doesn't make them automatically lose weight to take the vitamin D. So with that, I conclude our, medical and nutritional update for October. I hope you found it, interesting, and that, the material that I've gone over with you isn't too dry or esoteric. From time to time, I'm going to provide you with updates, hot off the pages of, clinical journals that you may not have a chance to hear about or read about. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.